Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein, and this week we have a wonderful show. We have with us Rebbetzin Chana Henkin, who married the grandson of the big guy in Rav Henkin, and she will be discussing the concept of Yoetzet Rabbanit. Yoetzet Rabbanit is a woman who's trained to answer shilas from other women that they are uncomfortable to speak to their rav about. It could be about taras hamishpacha, fertility, in general, women's issues. It's a concept that we do not have here in America. It is somewhat new. It is a little bit controversial. We will be speaking to Rebbetzin Henkin. By the way, her grandfather of Henkin was the one Pesach in the world that Rav Moshe Feinstein deferred to. And I heard many times when he had a Shvera Shaila, he would paskin and he would say, Lamagain Fregin Rav Henkin. He would grab his frock, put on his hat. Rav Henkin lived around the corner in the Lower East Side, and he would go ask Rav Henkin. So it's really quite an honor to have her on the program with us. We will also have Dr. Chaim Howard Leibowitz, a Harvard graduate, a famous doctor. And in Lakewood, New Jersey, he runs the largest long-term acute care for the chronically and critically ill in the New York and New Jersey area. And it's basically, it's an entire floor in Paul Kimball Hospital that's based for those who are critically ill, that in many of them, in other hospitals, they would have, quote-unquote, pulled the plug, done DNR, etc. But since by Jews, we understand that life, according to the Torah, is so valuable. Every minute is called infinite. The Mechal Shabbos, even for a chayel who only has a minute left to live, because infinity there's no price, there's no value we could put on it. So he actually, all the DNR halachas that we spoke about, all the rabbanim, it's all theory. By him, it's all real every single day. He deals with these shalos. So you'll have from him remarkable how somebody takes the Shulchan Aruch of Hilchas Ksisa, of Hilchas Chayla, and actually works with it in the real world. Fascinating interview. We will also be taking some of the calls. We will be responding to some of the calls. Maybe we'll take 2-3 calls that we've gotten over the last few weeks that we have not had a chance. I'd like to take those that are somewhat interesting or, often antagonistic, and respond to them. I'm a big believer. What does it say about Rabbi Yochanan? Me'olam le'amarti dava v'chazarti l'chayrei. If we can't defend our positions, we shouldn't have them. We're on the air, Matzah Shabbos, from 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA 570 AM and on the Nachum Segal Network. You can catch us Monday morning at 11 AM on NachumSegal.com. You can find all our programs at HeadlinesTorah.com. Catch up on all 100 and some odd programs, or on our hotline, same thing, 732-806-8700. You can listen to all past shows. You can also leave messages. We'll respond to some of them. You can email questions to info@headlinesbook.com. I do have an Agius. I would like to put an ad. We just finished Headlines 2. And Baruch Hashem, it sold out, the first one. It's in the middle of selling out. We'll soon sell out the second printing, so run and get it. Here's a letter I got from a listener. This Sefer is a breath of fresh air. I wish I could have had this Sefer when I was in yeshiva. It would have given me a totally different appreciation of learning. It does. It makes the Torah very, very real. Thank you. That's a beautiful letter. Here's another one from a listener. I keep on surprising my children. They thought I was a stick in the mud, an old fogey, a fuddy-duddy. The topics I bring out at the Shabbos table, you wouldn't believe the looks on their faces. They think that I'm really contemporary and get it. That's another lovely letter. So I whoever hasn't gotten it, go out and get it before it sells out for the second time. So we're going to play a few phone calls as much as we have time because we have some fabulous interviews. Let's go to this caller from New Jersey.
Yes, thank you for your shows. I would just like to comment about your thing with, first of all, it's called Hapeles, not Hapeleg. Also, it's a complete craziness since you have a karsatev to them. I hear so maybe you have a karsatev to the Nazis. They kept us in Germany for many years.
Did he just say that Israeli soldiers are like Nazis? Did I hear right?
Also, craziness and shove a karsativ to them. I hear some maybe have a karsativ to the Nazis. They kept us in Germany for many years.
Let's respond to this fellow. He's, by the way, responding to, I said that when we had the fellow from HaPeleg, by the way, the name of the party is called Peleg, Peleg Yerushalmi, that's with a gimel, means, I guess, the splinter. Their newspaper is called HaPeles. So he's a little bit confused, our caller. But what I had suggested, I had asked the fellow from Peleg, I said, why is an Ochi of Hakaras HaTzayv to the Israeli soldiers, and why do you hang them in effigy? I mean, they protect your borders. Does anybody, any a single one of our listeners, and call in, please, if you don't agree with this statement, does any one of you doubt that if the army were to walk away from the border and leave, it wouldn't take very long until there was a shechita, a butchering in Eretz Yisrael, that would be hideous, like in Hebron, right? Does anybody think that they would respect our borders? Like that the Notori Karta, correct, that they really respect us? Is there one of our listeners who really believes that? So the people who put their lives on the line, isn't there Hakara Sataiva? It's the most simplistic thing. You know, I remember I used to take my kids every single year in the summer to Eretz Yisrael to teach them Ahavas Eretz Yisrael. So during the Lebanon War, I went, and I stayed in a hotel. And there was a fellow by Shabbos table. He was sitting there. And by the meal, he was just sitting there like with a white face. I said to him, my friend, is everything okay? And he said, you know, I have a son. He's fighting in Lebanon now. He says, how could I eat my Shabbos meal? I don't know what's going on with my son. So how could we not have Hakaras HaTzayv? It's beyond me. So this fellow says, Gadol HaMachtia Yaseh Me'ahargai. Well, he said they're worse than the Mitzrim. The Torah says we have to have Hakaras HaTzayv to the Mitzrim. He says they're worse because it's a Machtia. By the way, halachically, I think he's wrong. Because the Chinuch says that the Chiyuv of Kibud Av Eim is Al Hakaras HaTzayv. And the Mechaba, I believe it's in Hilchos Kibud Av Eim, which would be Reish Mem, says that you're Mechuyiv to be Mechabed, even Aviv Russia. If a person, by the way, is Negev, a Balei Tshuva, somebody's a Balei Tshuva, he has a father who's an atheist, he's Mechuyiv to be Mechabed him, according to the Rambam and the Beis Yosef. And Ramah says, you certainly not, the Taz says, you certainly, Chas V'Shalom allowed to be Mevazahim. So you see, even HaMachtiyah, there's a Chiyiv HaKarasev. So this is, and I have another question for this caller. Why such a sinner? I mean, what have they done to you, the Israeli soldiers? Okay, you don't want to go to the army because of the danger. I understand. I saw the Peleg. They said they have to listen sometimes to women singing the national anthem. They say that even in the Nahal Haredi, the Fruma corpse, but sometimes, you know, there are women who pass by who are dressed on theistic and other issues like this. But what's the sinner about? I mean, you know, to me, it's like, you know, I once heard Rav Hutton said, he said that the minig was in Varsha, when you did somebody a favor, you would give them a bag with little stones so that when they threw stones at you, there would be small ones, not big ones. And I understand it as there must be tremendous guilt. Like, why this fellow, why don't you have a Karzev? And the answer to that is, you know, if you take it and you totally obliterate and you say they do nothing good, so your sense of guilt maybe goes away. I can't think of another reason. Now here's another thing. You said that it's like the Nazis. Would you have a karasata if you compare the Israeli soldiers to the Nazis? You know, we have Holocaust deniers in the world, those who say there's no Holocaust. But I think today there's a new type of Holocaust denial. And I think people like this are Holocaust deniers in some way. They're Holocaust denigrators. And let me tell you why. You know, I heard there was a store in Manhattan that was called the Soup Nazi. And what was the Soup Nazi? He had broccoli soup and face fuss. He had chicken soup, different soups. And if you couldn't make up your mind good enough, this guy had a big line. He would scream at you, which soup do you want? So they called him the Soup Nazi. You know, my dear caller, the Holocaust, they weren't called Nazis because you didn't have the right choice of soup. No, the Nazis were not Nazis because you would have to have a female soldier singing the national anthem or maybe dressed inappropriately. That's not what the Holocaust was about. Do you want to hear what the Holocaust was about? Here's a clip of a lady talking about what it was like her arrival in Auschwitz. I say shame on you. If you denigrate the Holocaust, you mevaza all the kedushim when you compare the Nazis to what the people protecting your borders are. And I really hope that you, my dear caller, you don't call your mother a Nazi if she serves you the wrong soup. Let's listen to somebody who was there who tells us what happened.
One day at nighttime, they came to the orphanage and they told us all to get up and not take anything with us. And just follow them to the truck. They put us in the trucks. And then they took us to the train station. And they separated us from our mom, the one that took care of us, who was a wonderful, wonderful lady. She was an older person, had a beautiful gray hair and a beautiful blue eyes and very loving heart. She cared for all of us. And she was separated with the younger children from the rest of us. And then when we came to the train station, they opened the big cattle cars, and they were full of people, with children, men, women, didn't know what was happening, didn't know where we were going or what they were going to do. They jammed us all in there. There was, of course, it was no room to even sit down, standing room. It was crammed. And then the train just moved on and went for a long time. At one point, it stopped and opened the doors, and they threw the rotten potatoes on the ground. And many people that were in that train tried to jump down to get some. And they would yell, "You're nothing but the pigs. Look at you." And humiliation began very much so. There were soldiers, of course, and we found out later there were SS troops, special ones that were assigned by Hitler to guard all of them. And when the train finally came to a stop, there were fence all around, and there were people everywhere in a striped kind of pajama-like clothes. We didn't know where we were. Found out after we went inside, they shaved our heads. There were showers that came from the ceiling. And then they sprayed us with the DDT powder. They told us to go into the corner and pick up anything that's on the ground that we can put on, those kind of pajamas. We put them on, and then they told us to go into the barracks. How many days? I don't know. Forever. Seems like forever. The work that we were assigned were the worst thing. It was the big wooden barrels that were filled with the half-dead children, babies, toddlers. It took several of us to hold on to them, to wheel it to the big trenches. We had to throw them in the trenches. And then they would throw acid over it. Obviously, it was a lot of crying, the bunks were not a bunk beds, they were just shelves, wooden shelves up against the wall. They had to crawl in and find a spot. Had to clean the latrines with our hands, scoop up all that. People died. One day, then they took us out of there, quite a few of us, and they put us on the train again, and then they took us to the Island Rügen, which is in the North Baltic, in the labor camp. There was a very heavy labor every day. We had to get up at 5 o'clock when the whistle would blow. We'd have to stand outside, wait to be assigned to very heavy work on the railroads, laying railroad tracks, digging trenches, making bricks, building for the homes, whatever, farms, everything. Can you imagine for the, and the food was once a day, the truck would come around with a cup of soup, which would be either pea soup with weevils floating on top or a washed down potato soup. Once in a while, you might see a piece of bread. Day after day, with a guard standing over you, if you stop, you're shot. Many died. But the worst part of it is they did a lot of experiments. They gave us a lot of shots. I don't know what they were, but one of the time is that I was covered with boils all over, horrible boils, and they were hurting very bad. But then one day they took several of us to a room, and they tied to the chair, and they took our tonsils out without any anesthesia or anything. Many died from bleeding. I don't know why I survived. I have no idea. The one blessing was the fact I was very little, very small. And so, therefore, I wasn't catching the eye of the soldiers like so many girls have. They've been terribly abused. Many would come back to the barracks and they would hang themselves or slide their wrists with a piece of metal.
That was a day or a few days or a portion of somebody's time during the Holocaust. And I hope we don't denigrate it. We're not mavaza these people by saying things like our last caller just did. Okay, let's move on to our next caller now.
Hello, I'm responding to the most recent, the scientist. You mentioned in your introduction that the Big Bang is mentioned in the Ramban. The Ramban says that Hashem created a nekuda, dakmai. The whole theory of the Big Bang is that there was no creator, that something banged into something else, which is utter stupidity, because there was nothing there to bang into anything if there was no creator. But Big Bang denies creation and says there was a bang. And the Ramban says there was creation. The Chiddush of the Ramban only is that he didn't create everything from Ephes HaMuchlot. He first created a Dover Dach, and from there he was Moitzi the rest of the world.
I would like to just respond to this, because I've gotten a bunch of emails, etc. The Gemara on Chagiga, Daf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, talks about the way the Rabbeinu Shalom created Shemayim Varetz, and he says, when the Rabbeinu Shalom Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav, B'shah Shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu Es Ha'olam, when the Rabbeinu Shalom created the world, Hayamarchiv Ha'olach, it was expanding and expanding, K'shtei Pekiyei Shel Shesi, like two lines going in different directions. Right, which is exactly Ad Shagor by HaKadosh Baruch Hu the Hamida. He said, stop. Amude Shemayim Yoreifefu. He said, die. V'hainu dam Resh Lakish Maidiksev Ani Kel Shaddai Ani Hu Shamarti Lailam Dai. So what happened? Bria was a tremendous expansion. And the Ramban says, like we said in Pasuk Beis of Bereishis, the expansion started from a tiny dot. The Gemara says it was Nespashit until he said, Dai, Garbai, he screamed at it and he said, stop, or it would have become the big dust, right? It would have become. And that is how creation happened, from a dot until a tremendous Nespashitus. That is what is today. I mean, so you could call that, I don't know, an explosion, a bang, tremendous, looking for words, I don't have a thesaurus here, a tremendous expansion. Science has given that the name, the Big Bang. Exactly as described in the Gemara, and what the Ramban says, it starts from an infinitesimally tiny dot. So the Big Bang doesn't mean that there were things banging around, or that there was necessarily any noise by the Big Bang, even though there very likely was noise, you know. That's a different conversation, but every Bria comes with coil, every happening, the Maral speaks about happens with coil. There probably was, but the Big Bang is just a way of saying a huge explosion. And the way we said it is until 1964, science denied it. They thought the solid state, that the world occurred forever. So I think that the way the Gemara and the Ramban describe Bria is almost exactly how thousands of years into the world, science finally caught on, just barely, you know, 60 years ago, which is really very astonishing. So it's not because there was banging, etc. I think it's really very on point. you know, my producer's telling us we're going to run out of time because we have two fantastic interviews. So we're just going to take two phone calls. Those are the two phone calls we'll go back to. And we have many more. Well, I'm sorry. I apologize. But let's go to our first guest.
Welcome, Dr. Leibowitz.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Leibowitz, I believe that in Lakewood currently you have a hospice care center. Am I correct or do I have that wrong?
You're partially correct. I don't have a hospice. What I have is a hospital. I run a long-term acute care hospital. It's not a hospice. It's a 50-bed dedicated facility to taking care of chronically, critically ill patients. The far majority of our patients, somewhere between 75 and 80%, get better, survive their hospitalization, and are discharged to subacute rehabs and home. I do take care of, especially for the Orthodox Jewish population, a lot of people who want aggressive end-of-life care, and I will admit those patients, realizing that they're likely not to survive their hospitalization, but just to care for them in the manner that is consistent with the best medical practices and also, you know, the wishes to comport with halacha.
So can you share with us some of the types of problems that you, halachic issues of end of life or, you know, gesisa, et cetera, that you encounter that you've had to go to Paiskim with?
Yeah, so to me, there's two major issues to me that where medicine and halacha get entangled that remain kind of knotty, thorny issues that we struggle with on a daily basis. The first, and a little bit, they're diametrically opposed. As a context, we all realize that the prevailing cultural American approach to end-of-life care, to medical care, to quote-unquote quality of life or sanctity of life is problematic for us. And we find ourselves very often in an antagonistic hospital environment. So thank God, Baruch Hashem, we've created a place where, you know, we don't just conform to halacha as a bidyevid, but we're structured from the very beginning to try to provide the greatest medical care with the greatest sensitivity to halacha as a mission statement. But that being said, we find ourselves dealing with two issues on a recurrent basis that seem a little bit problematic for us. The first is that there seems to be among major poskim, both here in the United States and in Israel, a sort of disagreement, let's say, about taking care of patients at the very end of their life. So I'll paint it in two extremes. There are some poskim who say that no matter what the patient's dying from, even if they have a terminal underlying disease that's inexorably leading to their death and they're being aggressively cared for, they may be on life support, they may be on a ventilator, but the more any moment that you can give them more in this world is something that should be highly valued. It's a tremendous mitzvah and something that should be done. So even if your person has lung cancer, let's say, and they have widely metastatic lung cancer, and they can't possibly survive derech hateva, and we're told to put them on a ventilator, to give them medications, to increase their blood pressure, to treat everything we possibly can, to put them on life support, to try to squeeze, you know, every day, every hour, every minute, and we're happy to do that. We also have patients who come in who speak to their poskim, and they very much feel that their poskim told us that there's no mitzvah to prolong their death as opposed to prolonging their life. And since they're dying of the inexorable march of an underlying illness, we should treat them, but to necessarily put them on life support, especially if it's something that they or their family speaking for them wouldn't want, is something that we shouldn't do.
Is there any pain involved in these situations or no?
So it's variable. Sometimes there is pain, and sometimes, but in the far majority of times, we're able to treat the pain. And sometimes you treat the pain at the cost potentially of suppressing respirations, but very often we can treat the pain. So I can find myself in a situation where I have one patient on one side of the hall that we're ventilating, putting on a ventilator, putting on dialysis, and pulling out all the stops because they're post-sake that, and I make sure their post-sake understands what the metzias is, and their post-sake says that that's something that we should do. And then I have a patient on the other side of the hall who presumably is in a similar medical situation, and their post-sake says...
Now, do you understand, Dr. Leibowitz, could you give us any color, because I'm sure you've spoken to the Apaiskim, if the patient is not in pain, why would the post-sake say don't extend the life? What would the halachic reasoning be?
So the question, a few things. Number one is the definition of what pain is very, very variable and very subjective. And even on a scientific basis, we have no way to really objectively quantify pain. So we have some poskim who say, you know, pain is pain. You know, pain is the pain of Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, who is being burnt. And, you know, pain is really pain. And if they have widely metastatic bony metastasized, we understand that that's pain. But sitting in a sacral decubitus ulcer and tolerating the repeated sticks of recurrent dialysis, that's not pain, that's discomfort. And I have another post-ake who now on recent two instances said that, you know, that's not discomfort, that's real pain. And to subject a patient to that
So Dr. Leibowitz, to conclude, you're saying that the amount of discomfort, the question is what verbiage do we use to describe, to articulate that amount of discomfort? And there are many people who would get considered, would consider, like, let me, you know, share with you, there's a chapter from Rabbi Shlomo Zalman in the Mincha Shlomo, it's in Chelik Aleph, and it's Simon Tzadik Aleph. He was asked a very sad case. He said there was a woman, if she would have been treated, she would have been paralyzed her entire life. And he was asked whether they have to treat her. They would have saved her life through this procedure, but she would have been paralyzed her entire life. And Rav Shlomo Zalman said, you don't have to do it. He felt that that type of a quality of life qualifies as pain.
Right. No, interesting that, you know, this type of judgment is something that we find very disparate approaches among the poskim. I just sat with a major posek just last week who wanted to bring a raya from the Rambam Hilchos Sota that a few years of unmitigated suffering is still pain worth, a life worth saving, and pain worth tolerating. It's these kinds of, and again, you know, not to come out on, you know, I'm not a bar plukta to come out here with a das and day on anything, but it's these types, I'm just saying, the challenges of living in a world where for one patient, we're doing everything because, and I have to explain to my staff, who really a lot of the times don't come from our cultural and religious sensitivities, that this is what's mandated by Torah law. And then at the same time, you know, I'm doing the exact opposite and explain to him that that's what's mandated by Torah law. So it's a difficult bar. I just sat with a posek who said that no matter that pain is real pain. I had another posek tell
so
me.
Can I ask you, Dr. Leibowitz, who are the go-to Paiskim, and could you give us, like, from the contemporary Paiskim and where they stand on these different topics? Because we have thousands and thousands of listeners, and, you know, maybe people who sort of are inclined to say, you know, this is what they believe, and they don't want to go to the person who takes the exactly hard line against that. Can you give us a feel?
I feel uncomfortable doing that because I sometimes feel, I'll be honest, even in my own practice, when I sit there with wonderful frum families who their one goal is to do the Ratzon Hashem, and they tell me, okay, so what do the posts keep hold? And I feel like if I give them menu options, then they're really not asking the shiloh. They're kind of they want the answer from.
But respectfully, Dr. Leibowitz, let me respond to that, okay? I think that the menu option is who is, you know, everybody has their leaders, their gedolim, their Eina Ha'eda. Well, you know, this is, well, he really has a strong position on us. Really, that's a rav that I really follow, so let me call him. Or alternative, it's more of, there are many rabbanim who just wouldn't even rule on these topics because they don't have the amount of expertise. So it would be more of a question of following a rav who you trust more than, or you have a hargash in such a sensitive, painful time, rather than going after the option that you desire.
The way I kind of understand the halachic lay of the land here, at least in, let's say, for the non-Hasidic world, is basically this. There's, you know, the way it appears to me over the years in dealing with this is, you know, there's the shitas of, you know, what they label as the Sitz Eliezer and the people who go with them. Typically the Eretz Yisrael poskim, Rav Eliashuv, typically Rav Shlomo Zalman.
Rav Shlomo Zalman, I believe, is very different than the Sitz Eliezer in this.
You know, so the question is like this. Even that, you know.
Well, but finish. I think Rav Shlomo Zalman was the one who said, if Shlomo
Zalman seemed to be more nuanced.
Don't do it.
Shlomo Zalman seemed to be more nuanced. But if you go with Sitz Eliezer and Rav Eliashuv and how they viewed things, you know, it's, if someone, there's no such thing as dying of cancer in your home. There's no such thing as being in a hospice and not in an ICU if you could get one more day, one more hour. And I've had extensive conversations with, you know, Rav David Morgenstern, who I happen to think is probably one of the most medically sophisticated poskim in the world. And he was in the chatzar of Rav Eliashuv.
Yeah, I remember well from yeshiva. He sat next to me in yeshiva.
Yeah, so I have privilege to speak to him almost on a daily basis about these questions. And it's very clear
that they poskim like the Tzitz Eliezer, that it's do anything imaginable to keep the person alive.
Right, exactly.
Even with great pain, if the person's in great pain, keep them alive. Is that correct?
It try to mitigate the pain, but they go with very much the sense that what the patient would have wanted. Even, you know, they're not a balabas on their own.
No,
body.
It's not relevant. What the patient wants is not relevant. And even in great pain, I don't believe the Tzitz Eliezer clearly rejects Ramesh's understanding of the Gemara Nedarim that pain is a reason not to continue life. Or he's, you know, he doesn't pass like Amsa the Rebbe. He learns it there from Shadonit. So pain
exactly.
is, so basically we do whatever possible to keep the person alive. That is one opinion. And then next opinion?
Then let's say, and then the other opinion seems to be people who are going in the camp, let's say, of Rav Moshe, and everyone realizing that, you know, Rav Moshe was, the ultimate authority here in America. And people now speak in what they would have, you know, how Rav Moshe would have held. And they're trying to glean it from both his tshuvas and the igris and time spent with him and Shiloh is asked. And, you know, obviously we're privileged to have Rav Moshe's sons and Rav Moshe's talmidim. And not that they'll tell you not necessarily that they're always poskening, they're trying to posken always like Rav Moshe, that they have their own opinions about certain things, but that is essentially the bar plukta, and that school of thought takes into account what the patient would have wanted, how they're relating to their pain, whether or not that you need to interfere necessarily and intervene if they're dying of, is there such a thing called extending death and not just extending life.
Who today follows that camp? I mean, Reb David Feinstein clearly, but he's very difficult to get a hold of. Who would follow Ramesh's opinion?
So I think there's certain talmidim, you know, of Rav Moshe.
I mean, I believe, and I don't want to put words, but I believe Reb David Cohen is of this opinion as well.
Yeah, I think Reb David Cohen's in this opinion. I think there are post-game, you know,
Reb Ruvin is clearly in this opinion.
Yeah, Rav Reuven's in this opinion. I think Rav David's in this opinion. I think that the first in Chicago's in this opinion, potentially.
Are there areas in your field of care that you find to be a big machlekes apaiskim besides this?
I think this is the biggest one, and if I just kind of cast it, is, you know, is it one moment, one hour, one day, or is it, you know, if someone's dying, that there's such a thing as not extending the actual.
I believe Rav Moshe writes in the tshuva, "Berur lo misa yasa."
Yeah.
So let me ask you another question, Dr. Leibowitz. Would you be of the opinion, and this is somewhat controversial, that for a patient who is in pain and he's at end of life, to sign a DNR?
Oh, now this is what I want to talk to. I'm glad you're asking me this, because I think that we potentially can do a tremendous service from patients and their families by giving them the understanding that sometimes hospitals and intensive care units and doctors, although well-meaning, and by the way, I am part of the well-meaning camp. I don't think that, you know, I'm a doctor's doctor. I don't believe that, you know, doctors are out there trying to do ill to anybody, but they have very, very different worldviews. So I think we do from patients a tremendous service by kind of telling them what our approach to end-of-life care is, and we're much more aggressive and much more interested in very proactive care, even at the ends of life, even at high ages, and even in difficult medical circumstances. At the same token, I think that we suffer because, you know, we don't approach this this whole topic with the nuance and sensitivity that it deserves. So we're all used to saying, like, DNR, you can't sign a DNR. That's a terrible thing, and they're not going to treat you, and we're not going to give up, and we're not going to sign a DNR. Now, and I think that in some instances that's appropriate.
I mean, clearly the Tzitz Eliezer and his camp would certainly help, but what we're going according
to
our...
No, but, you know, by the way, you know, even the Tzitz Eliezer in their camp would hold that in the situations where resuscitation is futile, then it shouldn't be done. So, and this is a tremendous service that we can do for people in your audience and everyone's listening. So let me give you two different circumstances. You have a 65-year-old guy who is shoveling his snow. He has a myocardial infarction. He's brought to the hospital, and he has a ventricular arrhythmia and a cardiac arrest. There's no question in anyone's mind that he should be resuscitated, and that's what resuscitative attempts were invented for. And, you know, I don't think there's any question about that. Then let's take the opposite case. Let's take a patient sitting in the ICU, it doesn't even matter what his age is, her age, sitting in the intensive care unit, who is dying of multi-system organ failure. And we're even in the camp of the Tzitz Eliezer, and we ask the appropriate post-scheme, and they're on a ventilator, and they're on pressors, and we're doing everything we can to them, and we're aggressively repleting their electrolytes and addressing their nutrition, and we're being as meticulous as possible in their medical care. And then it comes to the point where, despite all this, they enter the process of dying, and despite the best blood pressure medications to maintain their blood pressure, we sit at the bedside and we watch their blood pressure fall from 120 to 100 to 80 to 60, and we're sitting there and we're doing absolutely everything for them. And as we're watching them, we see their cardiac tracing on the monitor start to widen, their blood pressure starts to fall, and we know that despite anything you possibly can do for that person, that when their heart stops, it's not going to be restarted. They're not the 65-year-old guy. They're a person whose heart stopped because they have heart problems. They're someone whose heart stopped because their heart is living in a milieu that it's impossible to continue to go. So now, all of a sudden, their heart stops. There's no possibility of bringing their heart back. So if you explain that, and I've explained this to many, many poskim, and told them that the families around the bed, they're saying tehillim, they're saying goodbye to their loved one. Now, what should we do? Should we rush the family out of the room, break ribs, throw in some tubes and some other, you know, access devices for absolutely no purpose except to be yotzi the fact that we tried to resuscitate when it couldn't possibly work? Every single posik I talked to, except for one, but every single posik I've talked to, and I've talked to tens, said in that situation, resuscitating is tantamount to nivel hames, and it definitely should not be done. So it'd be a tremendous service for people to realize that as long as they're being cared for by people they trust, that in a situation where resuscitation can't possibly work, there's no mitzvah to do it. And no one.
Now,
you know,
what about, would intubation be, how would you rate intubation?
I'm past intubation. They're intubated. You've done everything. Let's get the most extreme cases. They're intubated. They're in the ICU.
Would Rebbe Yashiv and the Tzitzio believe you have to intubate a critically ill,
yes,
end of life?
Yeah.
They would. Wow.
Yeah, but I'm past that. They're intubated. Let's just accomplish one thing tonight. They're intubated. They're in the ICU.
So in that situation, you say a DNR, everybody would agree, should be signed.
If a DNR can be carefully communicated to the treatment team and to everyone, that a DNR does not mean do not treat. DNR means you're going to treat as aggressively as we possibly can. But if the heart stops, and it would be absolutely futile to try to resuscitate them, like we're talking about, you're not going to buy minutes, then...
No, but I understand. But if you're going to buy more than minutes, you're saying that according to the Tzitzeliezer, you would. That's his
potentially
opinion.
You would potentially do it,
yeah.
but let's just right now. I think that there are countless, and I just heard a story just this week of a patient who in a major hospital in New York, whose grandson came to me and was so upset because he knew that there's no way that they were going to be successful in resuscitating his grandfather. He saw it in front of him, but because it was the quote unquote frum thing to do to have a DNR.
So they tortured him to death, basically.
After he died, they felt the need to break ribs, throw a few, large bore catheters into his veins, and try to do whatever they could, even though everyone knew it wasn't going to work. And every posik except one that I communicated this to said, absolutely, if it's going to be futile, don't do it. The one posik who said, I still am not willing to say DNR, is because he essentially adopted a shita that I'm never going to say DNR because I don't trust the people taking care of the patients to not misinterpret it that we're giving up.
Well, but, signing the DNR is just really a form, but that even that price he agreed that if he was there, he would tell them not to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Leibowitz, thank you very much, and I have great admiration for you. I was by the Sheva Brachas, I believe, of you.
Yeah, absolutely. We appreciated that.
But notwithstanding my great respect for you and everything, I do wish you would go out of business, you and all the other oncologists and end-of-life doctors, and we should be zeicher where we don't have any more machlok.
Amen, amen. I entirely agree.
But I'm sure you would find another field of medicine that you would just be incredibly standing at.
Or we would sit and learn the Mishnah Brewer together.
That's right.
That was a fantastic interview. And now let's go to our next guest.
Rebbe Tzimchana Henkin, whose husband, who's a Gaon in his own right, he's a Mechaber of Bnei Banim, is an Einikel of the much revered here in America, Rebbe Leo Henkin, who was Ramesha, considered him his go-to. When Ramesha had a shayla, he used to say, Lama Gein Tzarev Henkin. So it's really an honor to have you with us, Rebbe Tzim.
Shalom, shalom.
So, Robinson, we know you've spoken about Tzniyus, and in general, you're an icon in Eretz Yisrael. Could you tell us?
Heaven forbid, that's not Sanua to say that.
Okay. What is Tzniyus?
I think it's a quality which is elusive. It's hard to define, but I would say that when I educate, there are two things on my mind. First of all, in terms of women's clothing, there are specific halachot of what needs to be covered. There are parts of the body that need to be covered, and we subsume that under laws of tzniut. there's something I think is much larger, and it addresses itself to both men and women. It has to do with the posture of an individual before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a clash of values between tzniut and the Western world. The Western world uses appearances, it uses the female body in particular as a tool to sell anything. We believe that appearance needs to be dignified, but not matter of display. Where the Gemara tells a story, which touches me. The Gemara tells a story of a certain eulogizer who spoke before Rav Nachman, and he said, "So and so was tzanua." And Rav Nachman told him he didn't think that anyone could really know whether a person was tzanua. Real tzniut is the way a person comports himself when he's all alone, in a very private situation, when no one is watching him. Does the person have a sense of wanting to cover himself, feeling a sense of tzniut? I think that that really gets at the heart of tzniut, whether a person is looking to make themselves bigger than they really are, or do you have a sense of lechetim elokecha? You know, the pasuk says, higid lecha Hashem matov, Hashem has told you what's good, hatznei lechetim elokecha, and the way you should walk modestly or humbly with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The way I always read it is v'hatzneya, if you wish to be modest or humble, lechetim elokecha, just walk with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You'll feel what your real size is, and you won't try to make yourself look bigger than you are. I think that's really the heart of tzniut.
So is tzniut for men too? And if it is, why isn't it discussed?
The Navi Micha thinks that tzniut is for everybody. But there's a part of tzniut which has to do with covering parts of a woman's body. There are parts of a man's body that need to be covered during davening. There are parts of a woman's body that need to be covered during davening and otherwise. So there's a tendency, because when we speak about clothing, we are thinking of women, there's a tendency to think that tzniut has to do just with women, but that's not so. It has to do with human beings and our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and whether what we're trying to make ourselves appear as is put on, is false, is bigger than we really are, or whether we're walking humbly with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And tzniut has a very strong component of humility.
So, Rebbetzin, in America, where it's all about, you know, individuality, self-actualization, how does how would you explain to young women in America, how are they able to be tzanua and still maintain their sense of individuality, not feel like they're sort of all shrouded up?
It's not just in America. It's in the modern world today that there's a very strong stress on individualism. But you know, people who walk around b'tzura lo tznua in an immodest fashion are also wearing a uniform. They're also part of the flock. It's not as if only those who are modest are wearing a kind of uniform. People tend to dress in a way that expresses a reference group, the group of people that they see themselves as connected with. And that applies equally across the spectrum. It applies to men, it applies to women. You don't express individuality by being dressed in an immodest fashion any more than you express individuality by being dressed in a modest fashion. One can find ways to dress modestly and to express one's individuality if that's what one is looking for. I think self-fulfillment is part of what tends to be stressed. What tends to be stressed today, but we certainly within Yahadut don't view that as our ultimate value.
And what about teenagers today? How do we teach them to embrace tznius when they so want to keep up with fashion trends, which are clearly not made by members of the tribe?
It's very hard. I don't pretend to have an answer to that. I try very hard to educate to thoughtfulness, to making your own decisions rather than being carried along by what's in fashion. But it's a struggle. Listen, there are a lot of things in life which are a struggle, which are not easy. And as Ovdei Hashem, we struggle. We struggle to educate to our values. Values are not easy. But there's something very interesting that I've been involved in, that I've basically built up together with my husband, that has to do with the tzniut a woman feels in airing questions before a rav. I've been educating at Nishmat, an institution which I'm associated with, women to be a front line to questions of Taharat HaMishpacha. And this has a very interesting history which connects with Tzniut. Many years ago, I began trying to educate women in Taharat HaMishpacha. I worked very hard in this. And I discovered that in any community with which I had contact, women were not asking enough questions. Generally, they were not asking questions because the matters of Taharat HaMishpacha are intimate, and they were uncomfortable to go to a rav. Some women were mekil when they were not supposed to be. Many, many women were machmir when they weren't supposed to be, with a high cost to shalom bayit, but they felt more comfortable that way than exposing themselves in discussing intimate things with a rav. So I spent decades trying to get women to bring their questions to rabbanim and speaking to women about how sensitive rabbanim are, and this really shouldn't be embarrassing. And I realized I was beating my head against a brick wall, that women were not going to rabbanim with their questions, and the costs were terrible. The costs included violation of halacha, and it included, as I said before, a cost to shalom bayit. It included a lot of personal suffering. So I've been... I'm not doing the teaching. I created a program. The teaching is done by Rabbanim. I created a program in which women are being instructed at a very high level for an extensive period in Taharat HaMishpacha, as well as in women's health, in areas ranging from gynecology, gynecological tests, gynecological issues of all sorts, to fertility, to women's cancers, as these things interface with Taharat HaMishpacha, we set up a telephone hotline. There's when a question needs psika, the women who graduate our program are called Yoatzot Halacha. And when there's a question of psika, they consult with a rav. We have a telephone hotline, which, as a matter of fact, is accessible from the United States with a wonderful phone number of 1-877-YOETZET, YOETZET, and it's a toll-free number. And our hotline works basically every day of the week. It works on Erev Shabbos and also Motzei Shabbos, as well as during the week. There are some hours. We also have a wonderful, wonderful website on Women's Health and Halacha, whose URL is www.yoatzot.org, with something like 700 or 800 FAQs and many, many articles, around 150 or 200 articles on Taharat HaMishpacha and women's health. And there also is the option of asking a question. The answers are all written by Yoatzot Halacha, but they're okayed by a posek before they're sent out.
And how many questions do you get a month on this, Rebetzin, on the hotline or on the?
In the course of around 15 years, we got over 300,000 questions on both the hotline, the websites. I think in the month of January there were something like 85,000 page entries on our website. The website operates in English and Hebrew and a little bit in French and Spanish.
And has there been any opposition to it, Rebetzin, to this idea? I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer, but there's Jews are famous for their two Jews, three opinions. Have there been opposition to it?
Here's what I would say. On the whole, the more people know about Yoatzot Halacha, the more they say this is a tremendous, tremendous benefit for women who just don't feel tsanua going to Rabbanim with these questions. There was recently an OU statement on the issue. And it mentioned that there was a panel of seven rabbanim to whom the OU addressed questions about women's role in a shul, what are proper roles, what are inappropriate roles. And we were singled out there as the only program that was that received attention by name, and I was extremely pleased by the reaction, in which the panel said they know that the Yoatzot Halacha are motivated by Yirat Shamayim and a desire to improve women's lives. They know that many, many women in many communities are addressing their questions to Yoatzot Halacha because for reasons of tzniut, of comfort. And the panel was divided. The panel was divided in its opinion, and the final analysis said if a Yoatzot Halacha was going to be employed in a particular community, it should be, of course, under the aegis, under the wings of a local rav, which is something that this is exactly what we want. And it said the decision should be left to local communities. So I was extremely pleased by that because it meant that this wasn't being confused with other initiatives which are coming from a very different place, maybe from a political place, a gender place. This is about improving women's lives and enhancing observance of mitzvot.
Okay. Rebetzin, I think that historically, there are so many stories, you know, where in the towns of Europe, the Rebetzin of the city, Paskin the Lada Shilas. It's like a lot of humorous stories about, you know, Rebetzins who used to Paskin, etc. So I don't think that it's all that new. It's just been sort of, you know, turned, made more systematic and more institutionalized rather, but we have a history going back thousands of years of Rebbetzins. The local Rebbetzin would answer Shilas. You know, there's a famous story where the fellow came into the Beis Halevi, I saw, and he asked the Beis Halevi's Rebbetzin if a Kohen could take an Almana. And the Rebbetzin said yes. Hey, or could a Kohen take a Grusha? And everybody, Rebbetzin, what are you talking about? So the Beis Halevi said, go ask her again. So they went running and said, what do you mean? A Kohen's not allowed to take a Grusha. So the Rebbetzin said, he's a Balagullah. He wants to know if he could take a Grusha. But there's a long, I remember that story, just the humorous. But I think, you know, for a thousand years, the Rebbetzin in the town answered Shilas. I don't see all that much new, except that there's an education process and it's more systematic.
So I want to differ a little bit from that. And I want to say that a lot of the questions which are reaching us today have a medical component, something which sometimes involves PSAC, and we're very careful not to go there. There is two kinds of answers that you can give. One of them is not paskening. Paskening is what, in halachic language, it's ledamot milta lemilta. It means to extrapolate from one situation and to apply it to another situation. We don't do that. The other is to give an answer, a straightforward answer, to a question which the questioner, regarding which the questioner doesn't know the answer, but you know the answer. And our women are tested across over the course of 2 years, and each time they finish a siman in the Shulchan Aruch, they're tested and in writing, and then at the end of 2 years they have a test for 4 hours, 4 hour orals before poskei halacha. One of the women who was tested first is a physician, and she said her medical boards were a piece of cake in comparison. But despite that background, we don't go to the place of ledamot milta lemilta. We don't go to the place of answering a question whose answer is not clear and written down and requires shikul hadat. Now, it's possible that the Beit Halevi's Rebbetzin had that shikul hadat, and he felt she did. But that's not what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is that there are women out there who are really suffering. I'll tell you a story in just one moment. And they need to be able to bring their question to another woman, and that woman will know whether she can answer it. A yoeset halacha has learned enough to know whether she should be answering the question or whether she should be calling up a posek. But if she calls up a posek, she's going to put the right factors on the table because she understands what's being asked. Very often a woman comes and she thinks her question is X, but the question is really Y. That's the kind of the thing that a yoeset halacha can get to.
Can you give us an example?
Let me tell you the story that I wanted to tell you. A woman called me up and very emotionally said, thank you for helping my daughter. Her daughter was getting married, and she had a problem in her system. So the woman said, thank you for helping my daughter. And then she said, where were you during all those years that I needed you? And I realized that there was a hereditary problem here. It wasn't I who helped the daughter. It was one of the other women. But she was calling me up as the person who started the program in order to thank me. And she was basically saying, listen, my body is functioning in this particular way, which has caused me untold anguish over the years in the area of Tarat HaMishpacha, and you solved this problem for my daughter, and now she won't need to suffer the way I did. We get situations like that all the time. There are times that a woman isn't getting to the mikveh on time in order to conceive, and that if she were to ask her question, she could get to the mikvah in time. I don't want to say that in every case there's a halachic solution, but in many, many cases there are. But if a woman is not comfortable enough to ask her question, because of what I regard as a very wonderful native sense of modesty, propriety, then the question is not going to be asked. And women are expressing themselves in enormous numbers that this is something which, this is a mitzvah that they wish to observe. But we should make it comfortable for them, dignified for them, comfortable for them to observe the mitzvah.
Well, thank you very much, Rebbetzin. It's been an honor having you on with us.
I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to remind you all, if you haven't gotten, go get the best halacha seifa you will ever get in your life. I shouldn't say that. That's being a little bit too sanctimonious. The best halacha seifa in English, printed this year, headlines too. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.